underground, the world beneath our feet. Landscape writer Robert McFarlane talks about it being a place where we have put things we treasure and things we fear for hundreds of thousands of years. Now, previous works by him, including Mountains of the Mind, The Wild Places and The Old Ways, they've been bestsellers. With Underland, A Deep Time Journey, he's decided to explore areas where the sun never shines. Now, he was recently awarded the Wainwright Nature Writing Prize for what the judges described as the this claustrophobic thriller of sorts. Fiona Gruber caught up with him above ground in Cambridge, England.
Some people might say my life is in a rut. I'm quite happy with what I got. People might say that I should strive for more, but I'm so happy I can see the same things happening here today. A show of strength with your boys' brigade. I'm so happy and you're so kind. You want more money, of course I don't mind. The public gets what the public wants, but I want nothing the society's got. I'm going underground, going underground. What if the brass bands play a start to pound?
So Robert, you're leading me across your lawn here in suburban Cambridge, as far as you could get from some of the wild places you've been underground. So what's under this lawn, Robert?
Okay, well, our site stops at our toes, but we've got grass, obviously. Then we've got topsoil, the mysteries of the rhizosphere, this incredible substance of soil. Then we've probably got a little layer of clay, and then under that is chalk. I live right on the border where the chalk takes over. And this is a chalk deposit laid down a very long time ago. It's Cretaceous era chalk, and it's made of the bodies of effectively dead organisms that floated down in a tropical seabed and then got compressed. So we're walking on a necropolis.
And here we are at your shed.
Okay, come on in. This is the man cave. Maybe that's the connection to Underland.
The human obsession with Underland, the underground, things in the earth, you know, obviously goes back to very ancient times. And you begin this book talking about that, talking about the Epic of Gilgamesh, talking about ancient Greek myths. Where did you actually start in your imagination and planning?
Yeah, the very first book I ever wrote was Mountains of the Mind, an attempt to work out why we climb mountains. And so in an odd way, 15, 16 years on, this just reverses that and says, well, why do we go low? But I realised quite early on that the answer to the question of why we climb mountains is a very young answer. It's only about 300 years since, in the quote-unquote Western or modern imagination, we began to climb mountains. But the impulse to go low, to go into the darkness, to make meaning and to seek meaning, that is much, much older. In fact, it's as old as it gets. We've been a burying species and a burrowing species and an art-making species in the darkness for longer than we've been anatomically modern humans.
And it's interesting when you talk about a burying species, because you make the really startling point that in recent times, we don't bury our dead. We cremate them and we scatter their ashes. And so much of our knowledge of the past is due to burial, and we are kind of erasing our own history by our burial practices.
Well, we're not burying people, but we are burying very durable things. We're burying nuclear waste, we're burying crushed cars, we're burying cities. So we're not leaving behind bodies so much anymore, but we are leaving behind future fossils that will tell a story of our species now. But yeah, it is striking to me that burial is something that we've been doing for tens of thousands of years, arguably hundreds of thousands of years. But that has stopped in many cultures, partly because of space pressures and partly because we scatter the dead now, as you say, as ashes.
You quote Philip Larkin, the poet, and he said in one of his poems, he said that all that will survive of us is love. And you come back with a very sort of tart response, which is no, actually all that will remain of us is plastic, swine bones and lead-207, which is a stable isotope at the end of the uranium-235 decay chain, which is such a horrible idea of the scar on the landscape, the scar under the land that we will leave as our legacy.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the animating questions of the book and of my mind, and I think of the time we live in, is Are we being good ancestors? That's Jonas Salk's brilliant question for it. What are we leaving behind us? We are a mark-making species. That's there in that extraordinary handprint on the cave wall, which marks so many early cultures' creativity. But it's also what we're leaving behind now is a much more troubling legacy, I think.
Your explorations take you to amazing places. I was particularly taken with a potash and salt mine that starts on the east coast of England and goes way under the North Sea. But it's also home to a laboratory for the study of dark matter. Tell us about this, because that blew my mind.
Blew mine too. I mean, what an amazing juxtaposition this is. So yes, on the one hand, there's a rock salt and potash mine, which is effectively we're tunneling into the resources left behind when a 270 million year old ocean that covered most of Northern Europe and the North Sea evaporated. And as it evaporated, it left salt layers behind. So there's this warren of mining tunnels that have been cut into these deposits. And they go, 5 miles out under the North Sea. I was down there and the guy I was with was saying, yep, we're under the coast now. Oh, we're under the shipping lane. Oh, we're beyond the shipping lane. This amazing sense of us there truly as a burrowing species, but also down there, nested like this little cuckoo of science in the mine, is a dark matter research laboratory. And the scientists go down with the miners, and the miners head off to the mining face way under the sea, and the scientists head into this dark matter laboratory. And there they're trying to peer into the great void at the heart of our knowledge of the universe, what Zwicky, one of the pioneering scientists involved in the investigation of dark matter, calls the universe's missing mass.
So why do they have to be buried so deeply?
Yeah, great question. Because rock is a really good insulator of the noisy work of the atomic baryonic universe that we inhabit. It shuts out a lot of the noise. So they talk actually, in auditory terms, they talk about being underground as being in one of the quietest places of the universe. And I like that. So they have to tune out all the background noise to be able to hear the faintest whisper.
That sounded like a pretty scary place to go. And there are various times in your journeys, whether you're with a caver going down and visiting ancient limestone underground rivers in Slovenia or in the West Country of England, or, you know, the man-made catacombs where you are in real physical danger. And I must admit that I just felt the claustrophobia rising. And I almost had to stop. You know, I haven't had such a visceral response. And you actually talk about several unfortunate explorers who have got stuck and never regained the surface. They've died down there. Were you scared a lot of the time when you decided to write a book about the underland?
Well, the underland's much safer than the overland. More people die mountaineering than they die caving. But I was afraid a lot. A fear is different to danger, I think. And yeah, claustrophobia grips. My goodness, it grips. It sets the heart racing and the blood pounding, and you can feel your body tightening. And I became very interested in claustrophobia. I'm interested in its power to communicate vicariously through language. And I'm delighted when people like you say, oh, I almost had to put your book down. Good, that's great. I'm thrilled. Partly just for the sheer pleasure of moving one's readers, but also because I think, as it were, ethically, metaphysically, we are living in claustrophobic times. We are in the end times in many ways, or it can feel like that. Time is running out, space is closing down. And so that idea of claustrophobia as a broader feeling of the moment came to interest me very much.
The tension between what we fear and what we're fascinated by in the underworld, I thought really kind of came to a point, what do they call the people who love when you join the cataphiles, the people who love catacombs, and and you went underground with them for a week.
It wasn't a week. I was down for the best part of 3 days. That was plenty long enough. But while I was down there, yes, this is under Paris. So Paris, every city has an invisible city, the city of supply and the city of communication, of tunnels and networks and cablings and so forth. But Paris has a true invisible city, which is the hundreds of miles of catacomb quarry network from which the stone of the city since the medieval times has been cut to build Paris with. And I love the thought the city of light has this twin underworld of the city of darkness. And you can't get into much of it. And there are cops, cataflique specialists in policing the underworld. But yeah, it was a place where people go to reinvent themselves, recreate themselves. You enter these party rooms where people are dressed as Indiana Jones, drinking vodka and listening to the jams going underground. And then you crawl through really alarming sections of semi-collapsed tunnel or you wade flooded tunnel. And all the time you're passing through phases of history, from Second World War resistance bunkers to the Nazi headquarters to 18th century mining chambers, etc. It's an incredible time.
And these people are people who you feel they like breaking the law a bit. They like going where no one else goes.
Yeah, they do like that. But it's also about crossing a border. When you go underground, you do cross a border. And for some people, that's a terrible border. The people who are working in dreadful labour conditions in mines around the world, or who are imprisoned below ground. I mean, the states and corporations have long known that what you put underground, as it were, stays underground often. But then people who choose to go to the Cataphiles, yeah, they love it down there. And there's a sense that they can be who they are not on the surface. They can reimagine themselves for a night or a day or a week.
You know, at the beginning you talked about it being a book about burial and unburial and a place to put things we fear and also things in people we treasure and wish to keep. Mm. I was fascinated that you took two objects with you on all your explorations underground. I'd love you to tell us about them.
Well, one of them is right here. I'm holding it in my hand now, and it's a whalebone owl. It looks like it was made in the Ice Age. Actually, it was made about 10 years ago by a friend of mine who cut it from the bone of probably a minke whale that washed up dead on the coast of the Outer Hebrides where he lives. And he cut this circle of bone from one of the ribs, and then with four or five strokes, he cut this beautiful, strange owl. It's about palm-sized, narrow, light. And he gave it to me at the beginning of the journeys that I made for Underland. And he said, this is to help you see in the dark. And it was a wonderful gift. And it did. It got me thinking about how we see in the dark and what we see in the dark. Sometimes it's horror and sometimes it's wondrous. And the other thing I took, also made by him, was, I guess, what I call the demon casket, which was this double cast bronze egg into which he had crumbled and sealed the ashes of a piece of paper on which he had written his hatreds, his fears, his anxieties, his demons. He'd burnt it and then sealed the ashes inside that casket.
And he asked you to take that with him because he wanted you to bury it, is that right?
Yeah, he wanted me to dispose of it in, he said, the most secure or deepest or darkest place I reached. And I took these requests seriously because one of them was a gift effectively of vision and the other a gift of darker things. So I did what he asked.
And where did you dispose of it?
That will remain undisclosed.
A man who can keep his secrets. The book does get darker and darker. You know, it's fascinating at the beginning to look at burial mounds and the burial practices and cave painting practices of our ancestors. But, you know, your book ends at a facility in Finland that is being built to store nuclear waste. And you come there from Greenland, where the melting of the glaciers is so alarming that you say that GPS systems actually warn people that they're about to crash into ice, but the ice has already melted, and that must, you know, be just a couple of years.
Yeah, that's right. The last third of the book turns north. It turns to Greenland, to Norway, and eventually to Finland, where this nuclear waste repository is. And actually, you describe it as dark. I hope it comes across that I found it unexpectedly a pretty hopeful place. It's actually the only successfully constructed high-level nuclear waste deep repository in the world. We've been making nuclear waste for a very long time now, and we've gained a great deal from it, but the thing we don't know is where to put it when we're done with it. And this is the only place where we've successfully, as a kind of community, as a species, built a hole in the ground that we can put this awful stuff into.
You explore the idea of how you're going to create signage to warn people about a facility that is going to remain radioactive for, what, 100,000 years? I mean, who will our inheritors be? And will they be able to read the signs? It's a really fascinating question.
It's an amazing thought experiment. How do we communicate across 10,000, 50,000, 100,000 years? How can we write a language that will be legible to humans, post-humans, non-humans? One of the answers that was given is we put the face from Munch's The Scream visibly above ground where this waste is stored, because all people will and all species will recognize that this is a sign of horror. But of course, if you met that painting in a decontextualized, you might think that this was somebody going, "Ooh, wow, how wonderful."
So, with a really weirdly shaped head.
With a very weirdly shaped head. So all signs are eventually susceptible to misinterpretation. The intentional fallacy holds across 100,000 years as it holds across 1 minute.
I'm interested in that question as well, because you follow paths that most people don't follow. Has that always been a pull for you?
Yeah, it's true that I'm drawn to strange people in strange places. You could put it like that. If I'm obsessed with anything, it's with obsessives, people who love strangeness, who know particular landscapes or particular sites incredibly intensely well, who look at the world slantwise and strangely. And also in this book, people who are, to me at least, working for the good, who are hopeful or inspiring in some way. So I love being with people in places that aren't always known about. So yeah, I think that's true.
And finally, would you love an underground if it all got too difficult?
Would I live in the underground? Well, I mean, there are people in New Zealand, as you know, and across America and Australia who are busy building their bunkers. People are already digging in for what might come. And it's an old, old impulse. There are many stories I tell in the book of people taking shelter underground to wait out the crisis.
Well, let's hope it doesn't happen. Robert McFarlane, thanks very much.
Fiona Gruber talking to writer Robert McFarlane, author of Underland, A Deep Time Journey. This is Blueprint on RN.